Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford.
In this week's show, we spoke with Google's chief innovation evangelist, Frederick Fert, and IDEO CEO, Tim Brown, about the importance of inclusion, psychological safety on teams, and empowering people with the confidence in their creativity and the courage to act on their ideas.
We hope you'll enjoy learning from Tim and Frederick's combined decades of design leadership experience as much as we did. Now, let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to another of our Creative Confidence series. I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard. Today, I have two very special guests. I have Tim Brown, who's been here before.
Hi.
But for the first time, Frederick Fert, who is the Chief Innovation Evangelist at Google. And so we're thrilled to have him here with us today. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Definitely. So we're thrilled to be here this morning. And the heart of this conversation is about talking to two leaders inside of organizations that have both kept creativity and innovation as they've grown across the globe and with larger and larger numbers of people needing to practice these capabilities. So keeping them sharp and on their cutting edge into the future. So I thought we would start off with Frederick in his role as a chief innovation evangelist. I thought it would be great just to get to know you and have you share what do you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here today. As a chief innovation evangelist, I'm really trying to help people to innovate. And, everybody's looking for the next big idea to solve some of our toughest challenges and problems. And, you know, in my role, I give people creative confidence to not just have better ideas, but also acting on those ideas with courage. Evangelizing is like from the Greek word, means kind of like bringing the good news, right? So I'm trying to bring the good news that everybody is creative, right? To use their creativity to really solve some of the biggest challenges.
Nice.
And it's about empowering people to innovate. So it's really my passion and my role.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I know that's something that unites all of us. And I think one of the things we've been talking a lot about at IDEO is that coming up with big ideas and great ideas has always been something we've focused on, but now thinking about how to make them actionable. And so I'm curious, some of the things that you're seeing inside of Google to help people execute and push those ideas into reality. What are some of the things you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Google has always been a place where we launched and iterated, right? So we really tried to put things out very early and then iterate on those things based on feedback we received from people. But in the last 2 years, really, we looked at a very specific thing. We looked at what is actually an innovative team and what distinction we can find between like an innovative, productive team and a not so innovative, not so productive team. So we really tried to do some research around that. So we looked at about 280 teams over the course of 2 years. And we really found that there's only one specific distinction between those two teams. And that is psychological safety. So really giving people inside a team the feeling that they can take risks, that they can try things out and bring their full selves to work. And now it's really our new kind of like, objective or goal to really build that psychological safety across Google within teams, because we can show that this really has an impact and this really produces great outcomes in teams as well. So it's not so much who is on the team, it's more how those people communicate so that they have empathy to really understand each other, that they communicate very honestly and openly. And it's really interesting to see from that research that we're now investing in something we call G-Teams that we give, last year, I think we gave it to 3,000 teams at Google. Really kind of like a tool that they can invest in their own teams to build that psychological safety.
Nice.
There's other two things we found, which is around impact and purpose. So, does it actually matter what you're doing on your team, right? Very important. And does it have an impact? So is your work actually in the team showing that it actually makes a difference? Hmm. So we took that research, to heart and really trying to now invest in our teams to really build the most innovative and most productive teams as well.
Nice. There are so many things in there. I think you can tell we're going to go deep really fast in this conversation. But before we do, I just wanted to invite, I can see people are introducing themselves and invite people to ask questions. We already received a lot of questions from the community in advance of this conversation, but we've got people all over the world. So folks from Switzerland, Atlanta, Taipei, definitely people cheering us on around psychological safety already, Argentina, Hong Kong, Delhi. So welcome everyone and thanks for joining the conversation today. So I thought you've already brought up so many great points about like psychological safety and how do you give teams control of some of those and amplify some of the factors that they're dealing with. I'm curious, Tim, some of the things that you think about. I think at IDEO, there's been so much work done to set the cultural conditions for a company to continue to be innovative at the scale to many places across the globe. What are some of the things on the forefront?
Well, if you take those three factors that Frederick has talked about, trust, purpose, impact, I mean, they're central to the culture at IDEO. And it took us a while to realize that's what we were building. But, I would say that they're the three most important things for us also, and always have been. I love the fact that at Google, you can run an experiment, look at 280 teams. That's one of the big advantages of being large scale, right? You can actually look for real kind of quantitative evidence of what matters. Ours is more longitudinal. Over 30 years, we've looked at this and seen the same things coming up time and time again. But I mean, the trust question is really interesting, and I think it shows up in different ways, right? So it certainly shows up within the team, right? So you need to have psychological safety, which comes from trust and optimism, and some other kind of characteristics that you want to look for. But it also shows up in terms of how others interact with the team, particularly leaders in organizations. And I think about my course, Leading Creativity. What I'm trying to emphasize within the course is how leaders, either in teams or who are responsible to teams or responsible for teams, need to behave. And you can think about how a leader could behave in a way to support and engender that trust and that psychological safety, or they can destroy it very, very easily. And we've all seen it, you know, where managers have started to second guess teams. That's one of the first things that's toxic to psychological safety in a team, or set crazy deadlines that don't allow the team to get anything done so that there's no impact. Another thing that we see destroys psychological safety in a team. So there's a lot of subtle human behaviors that can affect that topic inside a team and to a team, depending on how you act as a leader.
What are some of the things when you, I can see some questions flying by about teams where they feel like failure is not an option. There's not safety to fail in order to learn. And what are some of the things that you've done or that you've seen other leaders do to help turn that corner from an organization where people don't feel they have safety to fail in order to learn to a place where they do?
I'd certainly say that one of the recipes for, shall we say, not being as successful as you'd like, is one that I see often in large organizations, which is teams get time sliced, so they don't have enough time, which means they take a long time to go through an iteration and learn. And by the time they start feeding back learnings to leaders are impatient, right? So then you get this vicious cycle of trying to catch up with leaders. And the way to flip that around is find ways of being able to put in the effort to get to fast iterations and fast learning. The faster you learn, the faster you can fail. And it doesn't feel like failure when you're learning in a week or when you're learning in a day. It feels like failure when you're learning in a quarter or even longer, right? And so the notion of what is failure changes dramatically along the time axis. Mm-hmm. So I find that the best antidote to this not being allowed to fail is actually to learn faster, so that it is failure in the purest definition of the word, because that's what learning comes from, but it doesn't feel like failure to the organization.
Yeah. So the investment is a little bit smaller.
A little bit smaller. The learning's quicker. Mm-hmm. You can redirect in a more agile way, and it no longer feels like failure. But we have these long arcs, and the learning, almost whether it's positive or negative, to be honest, the learning when it comes after a long time feels much riskier.
I know we have plenty more to talk about amongst ourselves, but I can see some questions coming in from the community. And there's one exactly on that point about how do we start to measure, what are the indicators that we see that creativity or innovation is on the rise? So I think that's a super interesting angle that we, you know, the engagement is always key, desire to constantly be learners. But what are some of the things that each of our organizations do to see if that, or to measure if innovation and creativity are moving forward inside of our organizations or others?
I mean, we certainly, the approach we take is to look at the behaviors that underpin kind of creativity and innovation, and look for what evidence we can across many organizations that we work with, not just inside our own organization, as to what good behaviors look like and what impact they have. Right. So, we've discovered through our work over time that, for instance, organizations that can keep multiple ideas alive at the same time are far more likely to actually implement one of those ideas. Right. So if this is really what we think about, this is the kind of experimental capacity or the experimentation capacity of an organization. So if teams have can keep sort of 3 to 5 ideas alive in the process, then they're twice as likely to actually implement one of them as teams that do the kind of standard lean one idea pivot, one idea pivot, one idea pivot, which is interesting. I mean, that's just a discovery we've made by looking at how teams behave and what the results are, and not one that was necessarily intuitive to me, but those kind, we're looking for those kinds of measures, like what ends up working.
Yeah. And I know this morning we were talking a little bit about the mechanism of OKRs, or objectives and key results, which Google is well known for and many, many organizations are adopting, and making measurement transparent. I'm curious to have you share just a little bit about if there are specific behaviors that we count, and then how do you elevate those so that people become aware of them?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one interesting aspect, I think, in that regards is that, you know, we're truly trying to build products for everybody, right? Which is kind of like one of our objectives. So really trying to build products for people who are left-handed or right-handed, people of, you know, different backgrounds, different genders, different religions, and so forth. So if that's your aspiration, we're really trying to, we have to kind of like bring that world to the table, to the design table, where we build those products. So we really set the goal for inclusion, where we say, like, you know, we have to be the most inclusive organization, because then we can actually make that goal a reality about building great products for everybody. So if that's your goal, you know, we can measure, like, how inclusive are we, right? How diverse are we as an organization? And so one of the courses we ran with the Stanford D School partnership was around fostering innovation through inclusion. So we really tried to explore, you know, what's that relationship? You know, the more inclusive you are, you know, we see that the more innovative you are as well, and the better products you can build for everybody. So that's one of the approaches we take, not really related to like measuring creativity, but like really setting specific goals and how we want to achieve that.
Hey guys, just want to tell you a bit more about IDEO-U. We're an online school where anyone can learn to solve anything creatively. Built for individuals, teams, and organizations, IDEO-U equips leaders with the tools and mindsets necessary to ignite creative confidence and tackle complex challenges. This fall, register for Hello Design Thinking, our introductory design thinking class taught by David Kelly. And check out Tim Brown's 5-week leadership course, Leading for Creativity. If you're liking what you're hearing, sign up here for more at ideou.com/cc. Now let's get back to the conversation.
So it's interesting. So somebody, Jose, was asking in our community, is there one index that Google uses to measure creativity? But it sounds like it's more about specific moves that you're trying to make over time and then measuring progress on those specific changes. Is that accurate?
So, you know, one of the things we do inside Google is we have a survey called Googlegeist, right? Which is kind of like every year we measure the pulse of the organization. And you know, we measured in a couple of areas. One is around inclusion and diversity. Another one is around innovation and creativity. So we're really trying to measure, like, how do people feel around innovation? Do they feel they have, you know, the right resources to be innovative? Do they feel they have the right, you know, team environment to be innovative? Do they feel they have the right capabilities, skills, and mindset to be innovative? So really kind of like measure that. And then based on the results, kind of like we take action on that and really trying to put things in place so that we can actually look at the three lowest scoring items on that Google Guide survey and really take action on those to really improve. And we have kind of like a track record over the last, I think, 11 years since we ran the survey that, you know, we always took like the three lowest scoring items and then really made a company-wide effort around those things to really improve. And now it's on inclusion and diversity, which is kind of like our biggest priority. And that also relates to innovation and creativity, I believe.
And so there's some here. How do you recommend? There have been a couple things. So from Jenny Z, I can see when that's about recommending. How do you recommend a team manage a leader who interacts with them in a way that destroys trust? I know we've had other questions come in around convincing senior team leadership about creating the space for more innovation and creativity. So what are some of the things that you've seen in working with your own senior leadership or senior leadership in other companies that can help convince them that they might need to behave differently?
Well, I mean, you know, clearly, you know, at some level you have to get the dialogue happening within the organization about, you know, what leadership in this new mode looks like, right? Because it's a challenge, right? Because you're asking people who've often been very successful as leaders in a maybe a more operationally minded mode, where taking every little 0.1% out of of waste out of a system, which requires a lot of centralized decision making and a lot of kind of top down behavior, was the right thing to do. And then, you know, we're often asking them then to go and behave differently in a different context without giving them much in the way of kind of learning or help, right? And a lot of organizations are doing that. And it's going to be a gradual change, to be frank with you. I mean, we have to have the conversation going on in management schools, business schools, in organizations that, hey, we've got multiple modes of leadership that are necessary for our organizations to be as agile and as adaptable and as successful as they need to be. So that's the long-term piece. We just need to get that conversation going. And I would point leaders to as much helpful material as you can point them towards, right? And there's plenty of it out there now. And then, you know, I think my approach will be, and this is what I do with our own clients, is look for those folks that do get it. Hopefully some of them are, turns out actually often it's people higher up in the organization who have a little bit more perspective, get it faster than those that are fighting with the kind of the everyday kind of line responsibilities, who often have to deal with a lot of tension and kind of compromises. And get those senior leaders to begin to speak to why this is important and why it's different. And that again, that will start to change behavior. But it's slow, unfortunately.
Yeah. What do you see in terms of some of these kinds of roadblocks in an organization?
Yeah, I think just looking outside, I think we're living now in a world where we definitely have a lot of problems. So we're not running out of problems at the moment. If we're looking at healthcare or like education or, you know, climate change and so forth. So I think we have definitely a lot of problems. But at the same time, we are now living in a world where, you know, technology advances exponentially. So we actually see that we, you know, have some of the solutions there. And I think innovation really tries to kind of like close that gap where we actually can apply some of those technologies to solve really big problems. And, you know, I think leaders need to understand that. And I think a lot of leaders do. And so just it creates that urgency so that we have to act now and really apply those technologies to solve some of these biggest problems because, you know, now it's the time. And, you know, I'm quite fortunate to work in an organization where like innovation is really kind of like at the top of our minds and where we really see that potential in technology to solve some of those problems and really trying to help to, you know, improve people's lives through technology. And I think, you know, if you see that urgency as a leader, you know, I think you're on the right track.
Yeah. And I think there's so many different techniques that we can use to try to start to tackle these things. And I think both of our organizations are are well known for kind of framing up these techniques. So there are lots of questions coming from the community about different tactics, frankly. So I'm curious, I know we've got moonshots, we've got sprints, continuous innovation. So I'd love for you to talk about some of the mechanisms that you see inside of Google. So take moonshots, for example. Google's famous for Google glasses and self-driving cars and balloons that are bringing, you know, internet all over the world. How does the mechanism of a moonshot work across an organization? What and what types of situations is it appropriate?
Absolutely. So yeah, moonshot thinking or like 10x thinking, I think really helps to set really ambitious goals. I think that's very important that you start with a question, right? You know, a question which, you know, it's probably seemingly impossible at the moment. But starting with that question and really, you know, staying in that problem space to really, you know, understand how that problem unfolds and like, you know, what are the challenges around that and so forth. Because setting those really ambitious goals is also attracting the best talent, right? Mm-hmm. People want to work on really interesting big problems, right? They don't want to be the people who are just like turning the, you know, dial up a little bit here and there and make improvements on a very small scale. But people want to really, you know, work on the biggest interesting problems. So I think just framing that in an organization and having that language around moonshots and 10x thinking is really helpful, because that really helps you to also attract the best talent then to work on those things. And that's then just staying curious, right? Asking those questions, I think, is really important. Most of the time we really lead with answers, right? And don't inspire with questions enough. And, you know, looking at, you know, my children, they're asking, or like my oldest one now, 7 years, he asks probably about 140 questions a day. and I'm continuing to count that, and he's beating his record every day. but as adults, right, we're asking probably like 2 to 4 questions a day, right, if we're really courageous. We mostly, you know, want to lead with answers, and I think that's the wrong thing to do. Mm-hmm. So really, moonshots, I think, for me, is some way of asking these big, bold questions and just, you know, maybe fall in love with that question as well.
Mm-hmm. Right? I was going to say, I was going to build on it a little bit and say there's an approach that we use with a lot of our clients, which has got a slightly different purpose. It can sound very similar, but actually it's got a different role. So I think the idea of moonshot works really well in an organization that's got a lot of innovation capacity, because it's really about lifting the bar even higher and stretching for an even more interesting horizon. Many organizations are trying to shift from, you know, largely, and by large, I mean sort of 90% operational thinking, right? Mm-hmm. Running the businesses you have, beginning to think about how do we innovate. And we use a mechanism very often. We have a slightly different term, we call them beacon projects. And the role of a beacon project is not always to be a moonshot in terms of 10x thinking, but it's about 10x behavior. In other words, it's a project that's designed for teams to be able to break the norms of the organization. So, for instance, you know, in order to create something new and get it out, it means you have to go buy all the resources you need from the outside instead of using the resources that the organization already has because they're not right, then you have permission to do that. All of these kinds of behaviors that are required. If, you know, if normally the market research organization in the company says you got to talk to a 20,000 users and get this, you know, but what you need to do is go and talk to 5 users and get a really inspirational story to get you right, then you're allowed to do that. It's much about breaking the rules. And so the reason we call them beacon projects is they have a light shined on them, and they show that there are different behaviors that are necessary to innovate. And what the idea is then that you see that then begin to crop up more and more around the organization. Mm-hmm. So the role of a beacon project is more as much to illustrate that new behaviors are necessary in order to innovate, compared to manage, and to make that okay. So that's that's a slightly different idea to the moonshot, but sort of in a similar way, it's sort of a very visible kind of project.
Yeah, so interesting. So we've got moonshots, we've got beacon projects. These are all about bold shifts. And then I can see there are also a lot of questions about, then we come down to continuous improvement, continuous innovation. And so some of these behaviors that we're talking about need to be present. You have a fully innovative and a very creative organization. How do you bring those into something that might be a space where you wouldn't necessarily expect innovation, or you're trying to, so we think about the tension between creativity and innovation, which is quite messy, and then operational excellence and efficiencies on the other side. how do you sneak some innovation and creativity into the parts of the organization that might be a little more operationally efficient? What are appropriate ways to do that?
Well, I mean, I almost think the question's a little different from that today, which is like, in the sense that almost every process in organizations today is being disrupted by technology. So we think about industries being disrupted by technology. If you're in the publishing industry, you know you've been disrupted, right? But if you're an accountant, or you're you work in the legal department or the HR department of an organization, and you look out to the world, you realize your profession, your discipline is busy being disrupted by all kinds of organizations, including this guy's. and that what you think of as your contribution to the organization is changing very fast. I mean, it seems to me that if you're in any, marketing, if you're in HR, if you're in legal, if you're in accounting, whatever, finance, you have to be thinking about what change needs to happen. It's almost crazy to think that you would assume that simply doing more of what you're going to be doing today is going to be the right thing in 10 years' time, because many of these, many of these roles are going to disappear.
I'm curious. So just to get in a few more questions, we only have a few minutes left, but I'll pop in a few random ones from all the place. So Renata, it's thinking about ways to get these behaviors in and get people shifting. She has a question about design sprints. And so I know we've seen this in different parts of organizations come in to help unlock some of the things that they might be doing. But she's saying, Dave, what do you think about design sprints? Do you find them to be effective? And in what cases are they useful?
Absolutely. So partly my 20% project teach at Stanford D School, and I think they're quite famous for, sprints overall in design thinking in that regards. But also at Google, we use, sprints, design sprints, formats to really bring people together, right? To have kind of like, cross-disciplinary teams coming together, focus on a really big question they want to have answers to. And I think it's a good way to really bring people together and also have a structural way of, building that empathy muscle to really understand different, perspectives, different needs of people at the beginning, asking questions. But then at the same time to come up with ideas and then choose which of those ideas you want to experiment with, right? And then run those experiments. So I think it's a good structured way to come to an experiment and create learning from that experiment. And it really works because, people clear their calendars, people are kind of like, fully immersed, and they're kind of like really trying to solve some things quickly. And I think that time aspect around being, fast is very important, because the sprint aspect in design sprint is really important, because people just, don't have a lot of time, and or they feel they don't have a lot of time. So if you can convince people like, look, we're gonna hopefully find some interesting answers or interesting experiments for that question in a very short amount of time, I think those methods and frameworks work really, really well.
It's also a great way of getting more senior leaders in an organization involved in the creative process, because often these are people who don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
But if you're going to run a sprint around an important thing, an important topic, like, what's the core proposition of our product, for instance, if you're mm-hmm. starting, then you need senior leaders to be involved. And a sprint is a mechanism where it's reasonable to do that. You can get 4 days of 4 or 5 days of somebody's time where you can't get 4 or 5 weeks of somebody's time.
Yeah.
So I think as Frederick says, for purely practical reasons, it's got some usefulness. It's not always the best way of getting to the deepest ideas. Mm-hmm. We should also remember that sometimes highly talented teams working for weeks and months is what you need, and if not years in some cases, to get to really, really big breakthrough ideas. But sprints definitely have a purpose.
Yeah.
I think bringing that back to kind of like, the psychological safety aspect. So when we are running sprints or engagement with teams, we're really trying to build that safety environment, that trust really early on, right?
Yeah.
So that you can, even move faster in the process. And I think that's very important that you invest in your team in that regards, and doing that really early on. I also think, you mentioned kind of like, legal departments, HR departments, and finance departments kind of like being disrupted at the moment. So with a sprint, you can actually take a proactive approach mm-hmm. to really, you know, reimagine your role, your job, your purpose in a way. If you ask kind of like, you know, let's reimagine HR or kind of like, you know, what our department actually does. And I think you can come to really interesting experiments using that framework to really not just step back and say like, you know, I'm being disrupted here, but being more proactive about it and maybe optimistic about it and say like, you know, I can have a contribution here and I can really reimagine what my role is going to be in the future as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a different kind of space and time, which allows people's schedules to come together, brains to work differently, and different means of tackling big questions. So we have just a few minutes left. And so I wanted to ask each of you the same question, which is, what's next for each of you? What are the things that you're thinking about next in your career and the trajectory that you've already taken scaling creativity and innovation in the world? So I'll go to Tim first.
You know, I mean, I'm always asking the same question. I have been doing it for 30 years, which is, you know, where does design go next? And you know, as Frederick mentioned earlier, there's just no shortage of really interesting problems for us to work on. So I'm always interested in what's the right way to take, you know, design up to a level of complexity that it can really deal with the problems we have, because the problems we have are not simple problems today. I mean, you know, designing a better cup is a worthy activity, but it's not the majority of problems we face are not of that level of complexity. Mm-hmm. They're far more complex than that. And we're only just discovering how teams, how individuals, how organizations ultimately can contribute to that. I think if today we're talking about how can we get teams to be more effective, at some point we're going to have to figure out how can organizations collaborate together to solve problems that are of that order of difficulty, like healthcare or how we move around our cities or how we educate our kids. And so I'm intrigued by, you know, how we get creativity and innovation and design to work at that level. That's I'm not sure I've got too many great ideas about it yet, but they're the kinds of things that I'm thinking about.
Wonderful. What about you, Frederick?
It's a great question. And I think just continuing to think about that question, like what's next, is really helpful. Mm-hmm. Because there's many things you invest your time in. And one of the things I want to do is really develop that capacity to innovate in everybody. And really, you know, give people that confidence that they are creative and really act on those ideas with courage. You know, for Google overall, I think we are now at a time where like design and technology really converges. We see a very powerful kind of like things coming out of that convergence, where we see a lot of technologies can now solve big problems in the world. And I think making progress in that regards is really for us as an organization important. But for me personally, really focusing on the people and helping them to be their best and also act on their ideas with courage is something I'm quite passionate about.
Wonderful. Well, I feel like we've just scratched the very tip of this iceberg. There are so many more things we could talk about. So I'd love to invite you back again some other time. I really loved this conversation. Thank you to everyone who joined us and asked really great questions yourselves. I can tell a lot of people out there are wrestling with all of these kinds of challenges. So we'll continue this conversation in the future. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. For more on Tim Brown's philosophy on creative leadership, check out his course on Leading for Creativity. And to learn more from our Creative Confidence series, and for more on this conversation, go to IDEO-U.com/shownotes. Stay up to date on our Creative Confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and sign up for our IDEO-U newsletter at IDEO-U.com/CC. Thanks for joining us.